This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Transforming a down-and-out school. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
After closing because of academic failure, a school in New York City is now thriving after a teacher pushed for it to reopen under his guidance and vision.
Brace yourself for the worst year in history for ticks and other bloodsuckers.
Getting ready to retire? Here's what to consider if you're thinking of going overseas.
And how Apple is kicking out apps from the App Store if they track you without your permission.
Apple's become very concerned, and they believe that privacy is an absolute right for folks. And so they're erring on the side of good, and any app that captures your information, mostly your location information, and without your permission, and likely sells it to third parties, those apps are being pulled right now.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle on the policy change at Apple and the ripple effects it's having. He's here in about 25 minutes. How about this for a feel-good story? There's an imposing brick building in the Bronx in New York City that used to house one of the most troubled elementary schools. It closed after more than a decade of academic failure. Daniel Russo, a young teacher with a new vision, got the city's approval to take over much of its space and open a new school called PS 294. Now, after less than 5 years, it's one of the city's most successful public elementary schools for children in deep poverty, including many who live in homeless shelters. Terrific story by Wall Street Journal education writer Leslie Brody. Leslie, explain.
This is a school up in the Bronx, a bit north of Yankee Stadium, that was failing for more than a decade. It had all kinds of bullying and chaos, and the city decided to close it. And this young teacher, fifth grade teacher at the time, came up with a proposal for a replacement school, and 5 years ago opened it up. His name is Dan Russo, and he's 32 now, and he's the principal, and he's worked really hard to make it a better place and is succeeding very well, and with a very difficult-to-serve student body. I mean, about a third of his children are live in shelters or temporary housing, so they're really in the deepest of poverty.
How about that? I can imagine, though, a job like that is emotionally exhausting. What drives him?
I think he's just one of these truly committed educators, and he cares about the kids. He claims to know all 500 kids' names. I'm not sure if he has absolutely all of them, but he seems, from what I could tell, he knew quite a few of them and who their sisters were and whose mom was about to have a baby, and he's just, it's his, his calling.
How about that? We're speaking with Wall Street Journal education reporter Leslie Brody. She's written a piece entitled How One New York City Principal is Trying to Transform a School, and the focus is on PS 294 in the Bronx, led by a 32-year-old principal named Dan Russo. Some of these scores, too, from the kids have beaten out, like, top charter schools, haven't they?
On this impact measure, not on the absolute measure, but his kids have beaten the city overall percentages. For example, last spring, 60% of his kids passed state tests in reading, compared with 40% for the traditional public schools citywide. He would like it to be 100%. Yeah. He's not there yet. But for this population, that's a very good measure.
Yeah. So what does he attribute the test scores to? Just kids actually showing up?
Well, that's part of it, but he's also given his teachers a lot of professional development, a lot of training in how to help children who've experienced trauma. Mm. Plus, he's done things that would seem kind of common sense but aren't often done. Like, he has math teachers teach math to grades 3 through 5. In a lot of schools, elementary teachers teach every subject, and a lot of teachers aren't that comfortable with math. So, and the same thing with literacy. He has literacy specialists teach grades 3 through 5 reading and writing, as opposed to having these sort of you know, teachers who teach everything.
Yeah, yeah.
He also keeps a teacher with the same group of kids for 2 or 3 years, so they don't waste time getting to know each other in the fall. And they have a lot of hands-on projects to keep the kids engaged. He seems very willing to experiment and dive in with ideas that seem to work.
How about that? And all the teachers are on board, or does he get the resistance from some of those who've been there a while, or does he have a whole new staff?
Well, when the original school phased out, the union contract said he could replace half the staff. So he was able to hire, 50% of the teachers, and he worked hard to get ones that he thought would be a good fit. And he also made an effort to keep staffers who were well known in the community and were kind of entrenched in the neighborhood so that the families would trust the school. There would be some familiar faces looking after their kids. So that was also a way that he tried to, make sure that families would continue to attend,
yeah,
as opposed to going to a charter school or what have you.
Well, that's something. Some of his staffers, too, trained in what you pointed out here, therapeutic crisis intervention. Man.
Yeah, I think that's a way that is supposed to help teachers look at acting out behaviors through sort of a lens of how can we help deal with the underlying problem as opposed to being punitive. It's kind of a mindset as well as specific strategies for de-escalating outbursts. Yeah.
How's he doing with the absenteeism?
It's getting better. I think he did about the city average.
Okay.
What has also helped is that the city a few years ago decided to start providing busing to children in shelters, and that made it easier for them to attend. A lot of times when children were getting moved from shelter to shelter, they would be taken away from the neighborhood of the school they were attending, and they would lose class time enrolling in a new school or getting shuffled around. So the city started to provide busing so that they could keep going to the same schools, even if they moved around where they were sleeping at night. Mm. And that apparently has helped quite a bit. And also the social workers, he has extra social workers that really make an effort to explain to parents why it's important to be get to school and be there on time. Because some parents that didn't think kindergarten, for example, was really so necessary,
yeah,
and so they wouldn't always show up, and he tried to convince them of the value of what they learned in kindergarten and the good habits that come from showing up.
It's inspirational, right? Wall Street Journal education writer Leslie Brody. 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you're with us on this Mother's Day weekend. The Center for Disease Control estimates that about 300,000 Americans are infected with Lyme disease each year. Between reported and unreported cases, this year health officials are expecting the worst tick season ever. For more, we're joined by Dr. Christine Horner, natural health expert. Doctor, set up the basics here.
Lyme disease is spread by a tick, and that there's one particular variety called the deer tick or the black-legged tick that carries the Lyme disease. Usually this tick is extremely small, so it's hard to see. It could be the size of a poppy seed or a pinhead. It's endemic kind of in the northeast, but also it's spreading kind of across the country. We can find it in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and it's even showing up in Northern California.
Mm.
The problem with this particular disease is that it causes really severe symptoms, and it's really kind of hard to diagnose, and that's why it's so important to get informed about this so that you can have suspicions about it and get treated properly. If you catch it early, then it is actually very treatable with antibiotics. Another thing that's kind of common is to get a rash, there too. So there's a bullseye rash that's classically described, but unfortunately it only happens in about 10% of people, and then you can get like a flat rash or something that in about 30% of people. But anyway, if you catch it early, like I said, antibiotics are something that are very effective. And if it goes on later, that infection caused by Borrelia, Burgdorferi is the name of the bacteria, it can go to your muscles, it can go to your joints, and it can even go to your brain and cause cognitive problems.
We're speaking with Dr. Christine Horner, natural health expert, also author of a book called Radiant Health, Ageless Beauty, and we're talking about ticks and Lyme disease. Do you say, generally speaking, that Lyme disease is curable or just manageable?
Well, both. So, first of all, prevention, always prevention, you know, is better. Like I said, keeping your immune system strong is one of the most important things that you can do, too. So that is all about diet and lifestyle, reducing stress, getting, you know, plenty of rest, and, you know, doing exercise and so forth. Vitamin D is another thing that's really important for the immune system. Omega-3 fatty acids, huge anti-inflammatory properties to them. You want to take those supplementally, I think, just for good health, you know, every day.
Right.
But it's also very beneficial for Lyme's disease. You got to check your levels to make sure you're taking enough. And if you get into that situation where you have, you know, a chronic disease, antibiotics are not effective for it, but there are lots of different kind of natural approaches, from using these very different nutritional supplements to other specific protocols. That there's certain naturopaths and integrative doctors that actually specialize this in helping to get rid of the Lyme.
Nice, Doctor. Dr. Christine Horner. It is 20 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend, time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. There's a new twist when it comes to your smartphone privacy. Apple is reportedly removing apps from the App Store if they share your location. 9to5Mac reports that Apple has recently been removing apps that are sharing location data with third parties and sending the app developers a notice that the app is violating the App Store review guidelines. More from tech analyst Rob Enderle. Rob, what's happening here?
Well, so Apple's become very concerned. In fact, they're not the only one. Microsoft is on a rant on this as well with regard to privacy, and they believe that privacy is an absolute right for folks. And so they're erring on the side of good, and any app that captures your information, mostly your location information, and without your permission, and likely sells it to third parties, those apps are being pulled right now. So if you've got an app like that, you probably don't have one today because it's been pulled from the store.
Wow. All right, do they get I guess some sort of warning to fix it, or like how does that work?
Well, basically there's no warning. It's they get a note that says their app has been pulled, and they're welcome to resubmit it when they fix the app. So Apple's been promising to do this for some time, but they just flipped the switch and decided to execute. So I think the developers had a lot of warning here.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of them took Apple seriously, and those folks are now wondering where the revenue went today.
Wow. All right, so what kind of trend could this start?
Well, both Microsoft and Apple are just kind of rabid on this. The idea that the kind of thing that happened over with Facebook and often happens with Google will simply just not happen with them. And it's one of the ways the firms are differentiating from the ad-based firms, and also one of the ways these firms are standing up for the rights of their users. So for the most part, I think it's a good thing.
Okay. So some of this, I guess, is what, ahead of privacy laws that are going to go into effect in Europe?
Yeah, if you've been watching, Google's been incredibly hostile towards other providers on their platform that are capturing information, locking them out as well unless they aggressively use Google services. It's kind of an interesting response, very similar to what Microsoft initially did with the EU until the EU started fining them billions of dollars. So we'll see how that works out for Google.
Wow.
But the GDPR stuff, the European Union is incredibly aggressive with regard to protecting user information, and most firms are not compliant. Apple and Microsoft are both trying to make sure that they are compliant. I think Microsoft said they would be compliant by the end of yesterday, and Apple's rolling on an aggressive schedule as well, and this is part of that.
Hmm. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's principal and founder of the Enderle Group, a tech advisory firm. And we're talking about Apple pushing back at some of these apps that snoop on you, especially with regards to location. Is this all fallout from the Facebook and Cambridge Analytica dust up?
Well, but a lot of it's GDPR, I think the Facebook dust up really made this a much higher priority than it otherwise might have been. I mean, the fact that Cambridge Analytica has actually gone under as a result of that, I think, was a huge wake-up call for the tech firms. And so the firms are becoming much more aggressive at how they're dealing with this particular problem. Nobody really wants to the unemployed as a result of a problem like this. And I think Cambridge Analytica showcases that's a likely outcome if you're on the wrong side of the EU in this regard.
You think with what Apple is doing here, we are better protected as consumers or not necessarily?
I think both Microsoft and Apple are aggressively moving to protect us as consumers, and I don't see that as a bad thing. It's going to be interesting to see how the ad-focused companies, the Googles and Facebooks, do this, because they basically make their living selling our information.
Yeah.
And so they've got a much more difficult path to get into compliance. Apple and Microsoft historically do not sell that information, and so their path to fixing the problem is far shorter.
All right, so for these apps that were tracking, say, our location, can they now not charge as much money, say, to an advertiser because they have less data to present them?
I think the problem is for those apps, if they've been disabled, they don't have users. So yeah, the advertisers aren't going to pay them anything because they won't have any eyeballs. So yeah, it's a serious problem for the apps that have been disconnected because they effectively are out of business right now, and at least on the Apple platform.
No, and I mean, they're going to take it back in house, fix it, and then relaunch the app. But perhaps an advertiser is not as interested because it can't find specifically where we are for something.
Yeah, their revenue opportunity has been reduced, especially if their users come back and say, "Yeah, we don't want to share that information with you, and we don't want you to share that information with anybody else," which is what the EU was looking for. So, depending on how many users do that, you could certainly opt in, but it should reduce rather substantially their total available market.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, how to retire overseas. Also, a new way to approach things when your smartphone is almost out of battery. And Mother's Day traditions from around the world. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, you can imagine that the nuptials of Britain's Prince Harry and actress Meghan Markle will be pricey, with some guessing close to $3 million. But they've managed to save money on one big part of the day. The 1,200 members of the public they've invited to watch the wedding on the grounds of Windsor Castle will have to bring their own food. And no drinks will be served. But there are better ways. The non-royals among us can save money. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you're not having a royal wedding where taxpayers will help foot some of the bill, how can you save some money on your big day? Leslie Albrecht, personal finance reporter for MarketWatch, has some tips and joins us now. Leslie, what's the average wedding costing these days?
Well, that would be $33,000 in 2017. So you could either, buy a really nice car or get married.
What is the importance of budgeting for your wedding as you're starting out?
You have to be honest with yourself and your partner about what you're willing to spend and what you can spend. And I think a big reason for that is that a lot of people actually end up having regrets about what they spend on their wedding. And it's so sad to think that, like, this day that's supposed to be your happy, happy day turns out to be something that's tinged with regret. And in fact, 43% of couples say that they had flat-out regret about their wedding spending.
And a lot of people are getting into debt, and that's not really a great way to start out, is it?
Exactly, yeah. Not exactly the first step to building your nest egg.
All right, one of the tips for saving some money is the time of year you get married. What about that?
Yeah, this is a good one if you're willing to do it. A lot of people have their heart set on like a warm weather wedding, but if you can do it in the winter, you can get a discount at a lot of venues because they're trying to attract visitors.
And I think, Leslie, the recent information is that fall is becoming a much more popular time than spring and summer, which is a little surprising.
Yes, we actually wrote a story about that, and that has to do with people, they like the rustic barn feel for their wedding, and that is maximized in the fall when you can have the pretty leaves in the background. So that's what that's about.
We're speaking with Leslie Albrecht of MarketWatch. Leslie, how about the clothes that you wear, especially the dress would be the most expensive part of the attire?
It is, and I just want to point out that on the list of regrets that people have, the dress is high on the list in terms of what they spend. So one way to avoid that is to go to your department store and look in the prom section, where they have perfectly nice white dresses or light-colored dresses that you can, pass off as a wedding dress.
Is there a trend at all to use, I don't want to say use, gently used dresses, gently owned, previously owned dresses?
Yeah, that is a thing. And, you know, there's like these services that have developed that help brides find gently used dresses. And I think that's definitely something to look into because obviously they're gently used. People only wear them for like 12 hours and then they sit in the closet for the next 10 years.
So sometimes people wouldn't even know, right?
Exactly.
What about food and drinks? How do we save some money there?
Okay, well, one way is to let go of your idea of having this like 3-level cake that's, you know, 3 feet high and just go for a modest 2-tier one or even a sheet cake, which I know sounds a little, you know, like a birthday party, but you can do that and it's a good way to save money. And then another thing is, I thought this was kind of funny, serve your cocktails in small glasses. Because a lot of times people have these signature cocktails that they like to have during the reception. But the truth is most guests just have the signature cocktail and then they go back to their favorite drink. So why spend money pouring those out in these huge glasses? Put them in small glasses, save money, let the guests have a taste of it, and then they can go back to their gin and tonic or whatever.
But what about decorations and when you're trying to make things look pretty for your day?
Well, a lot of people get their heart set on like a certain color of flower to go in to, you know, to match the rest of their themed colors. But one way to save money is to go with local flowers that are in season because those cost less. They might not be the color you want, but they will probably fit your budget better.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Market Watch reporter Leslie Albrecht. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your Mother's Day weekend with us. Retiring overseas and investing in property abroad is no longer only for the wealthy, and it's a growing trend among the middle class. The State Department says 8.7 million Americans live abroad, and more than 500,000 Social Security payments per month are sent to overseas residents. That's up from 400,000 just in 2016. Interested? More on what it's like from Kathleen Petticord, who's got a book called How to Retire Overseas. It's just been released. Kathleen, how popular is this?
I've been covering this beat and writing about this topic for more than 30 years. And way back then, this was a very fringy idea. Today, I think of it as increasingly almost mainstream. And I've been interviewed, for example, recently by Reader's Digest. And when Reader's Digest is covering a topic, it's not a fringy idea anymore. It's something that mainstream Americans are interested in. And I think that's definitely the case here. More Americans are doing this than ever. And many millions of Americans are currently living as retirees in other countries.
Wow. Is it difficult logistically to pack up and move somewhere else, especially out of country?
It can be difficult, and it depends on how you approach it. And I think maybe one important starting point is to realize it doesn't have to be all or nothing. So you don't have to decide, I'm moving to France, or I'm moving to Panama, or Thailand, or wherever, and so I'm selling everything, I'm packing up, and that's it. I'm leaving my home, and my family, and my friends, and everything I've known and been comfortable with to this point in my life, and I now live in France forever. Goodbye. Mm. That's kind of a big, scary idea for most people, although some people do that and are very happy. But, you know, this can be very customizable. So you can decide that you want to spend a month or 3 months, a year in another part of the world where the season is especially appealing at a certain time, and you just take advantage of it. It's kind of an adventure, you know. It's different outside the box. It can be really fun. But you're not ready to walk away from your home, and that can be okay.
We're speaking with Kathleen Petticord. She's written a book entitled How to Retire Overseas, Everything You Need to Know to Live Well for Less Abroad. Okay, so if you're doing it for those short periods of time, you don't have to worry about things necessarily, like what, Social Security, for example?
Well, you don't have to worry about, for example, residency. And that's probably the biggest complication if you want to move full stop and live full time in another country. Then you need to apply for legal resident status. And that's easy in a lot of places around the world. American retirees are kind of an industry, to put it kind of bluntly. You know, a lot of countries, developing countries especially, like Costa Rica, Panama, Mexico, Belize, they're eager to attract American retirees and their retirement dollars. And so they make it very easy to establish residency, and they even offer benefits, tax discounts and other discounts and perks for being a retiree resident in that country. Not every country offers this. New Zealand and Argentina, for example, at the other extreme, they just flat out don't want any kind of foreign retirees, really, and so it's almost impossible to establish legal residency.
Wow.
So the first step to understand if you want to move full-time to a new country is what are your options for becoming a legal resident there? How difficult and how expensive will it be? In a lot of cases, the answer is not so difficult and not so expensive. You just go through the process.
Hmm.
That's really the most important complication to address. Another would be health care and health insurance. And a starting point thing to understand there is that your U.S. health insurance isn't probably going to follow you wherever you're going. You're going to have to consider other options.
So explain your story a little bit, because before we started here, you mentioned that you live in Panama City, Panama.
I do. I've been outside. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. Grew up there, and then about 21 years ago left and moved to Ireland, and I lived with my family in Waterford, Ireland for 7 years, and then we moved to Paris, and we lived in Paris for 4 years, and most recently I've been in Panama City for 10 years.
Thanks, Kathleen. Kathleen Petticord, again, the book is called How to Retire Overseas. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Does your heart rate jump when your iPhone battery dips below 20%, you could be suffering from what some experts term low battery anxiety. Do your palms sweat when you have no access to cell service? You could have an acute case of nomophobia, short for no mobile phobia. Wall Street Journal reporter Trip Mickle has a look at some of the research on this. Trip, what have you found?
The catalyst for this was really an app called Die With Me that was designed to provide a chat room or a place that people could go to when they got all anxious and nervous as their battery died.
Jeez.
And in looking into that, I discovered that there's actually a whole ecosystem of researchers out there that are looking into the anxieties we experience as a consequence of our smartphones that seem to be kind of a third arm, if you will, for us this day and age.
Right. All right. So the cell phone dying or getting below 20%, I guess, is one cause of anxiety. What else is out there?
Let's see, other causes of anxiety, just forgetting your phone. We've all probably walked out the door and, you know, maybe even gone just for a walk with the dog, which is only going to take 10 or 15 minutes, and, you know, had our heartbeats, you know, accelerate just because we realize as we walk out the door, like, oh, whoops, I left my phone behind. You know, you have many instances along those lines that they can trigger spikes in your heart rate. I mean, others could be, you know, being in a meeting and getting you know, a text message and recognizing, like, it's not socially acceptable to look at that text message, but having a gnawing fear that that text message is important and you need to respond right away.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal technology reporter Trip Mickle. His piece is called Your Phone is Almost Out of Battery. Remain calm. Call a doctor. You referenced the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Explain some of the research, I guess, that has set this up. What are they finding? Because they're noticing, right, that heartbeats are racing at times when stuff happens
right
with a cell phone.
Right. You know, I was talking to this researcher out of the University of Toledo who really put in context what these researchers are doing. And, you know, his quote was, experimenters can be mean. And he said that because a lot of the experiments they're designing at this juncture involve separating people from their phone and seeing how people react. So they've got studies at Missouri. They've done studies at Toledo. They've done studies at Cal State. And they essentially have a participant come into a psych lab. The person who's running the study will say something to the effect of, listen, we're going to have you watch this video. To do it and make sure you're going to stay focused on the video, just hand me your cell phone. I'm just going to put it right here behind you. They'll turn on the video, and then once the video starts playing and the person's seated about 3 to 5 feet from their phone, they'll start texting that phone, and the person is hooked up to galvanic measuring systems, which kind of, you know, are essentially plugs on your fingers that monitor your anxiety, and they watch as anxiety spikes as these text messages come in, and depending on how dependent people say they are on their smartphone, there's a correlation between that dependency and just how much their anxiety spikes in this psych experiment.
Thanks, Trip. Wall Street Journal reporter Trip Mickle. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. On Sunday, Americans celebrate Mother's Day, an annual holiday, of course, filled with flowers, gifts, and the classic breakfast in bed versus brunch out conundrum. But we're not the only country that celebrates moms. The Huffington Post found traditions in other countries. In Japan, for example, people typically celebrate by giving their mothers red carnations. The holiday did not become popular until after World War II, as Japan had previously banned many Western practices and influences. Many Ethiopians celebrate Mother's Day with a three-day festival called Antrasht, which marks the end of the rainy season, typically sometime in the fall. Antrasht celebrations involve singing, dancing, and feasting. Mother's Day can be a pretty big deal in Mexico, too. People take the mothers in their lives out to eat at restaurants, and mariachi bands serenade them with renditions of Las Mananitas. Mother's Day in Thailand is in August. There are many parades to celebrate the occasion. Jasmine is a popular gift. Ancient Egyptians esteemed motherhood and celebrated it with an annual festival to honor the goddess Isis, who represented the ideal mother and wife. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.